A couple of states have already legalized marijuana use, and not just for medical reasons, but many more could be on the horizon. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll look at the possibility of Arizona voters approving legalization, and we'll find out why some state prosecutors have come out so strongly against it. Plus, an Arizona Republic editorial proposed the idea of appointing rather than electing members of the Corporation Commission. There's been buzz in the past about applying that to superintendent of public instruction and treasurer, too. So what are the potential pluses and pitfalls? We'll find out. Also, another new supermarket chain is landing in the Valley later this month, ready to compete with other big and small names. And Whole Foods is looking to appeal to millennials. What kind of impact could we see? I'll talk to former supermarket executive Joe Dobrow. And SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, has a new interim director. We'll introduce you to Sarah Cochran. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A former governor of Utah, who is now a leader of a group pushing for congressional action to address gridlock and dysfunctional politics, will address University of Arizona grads at their commencement ceremonies. KJZZ's Dennis Lambert has more.
The group's agenda includes job creation, a balanced federal budget, and energy independence. Former Utah Governor John Huntsman is co-chair of the group No Labels. Huntsman will receive an honorary degree during the commencement Saturday night in Arizona Stadium. The university says it's conferring degrees upon more than 5,600 eligible grads and that more than 4,000 have registered to attend the commencement ceremony, along with about 40,000 guests. Dennis Lambert, KJZZ News.
Border Patrol agents have arrested a pair of smugglers trying to travel across the desert between Welton and Gila Bend on ATVs. Spokesman Richard Withers says air patrols helped locate the smugglers, who were carrying 9 bundles of marijuana.
Our video surveillance and with the help, of course, of Yuma Air Marine, we were able to spot the smugglers, and we were able to intercept them.
Withers says it's not the first time agents have seen ATVs used to transport drugs across the border, but that the smugglers may be trying old tricks since many of their efforts have been failing.
From the KJZZ newsroom, I'm Carrie Young. The mother of a Mesa police officer killed by an impaired wrong-way driver is suing the state. The lawsuit alleges there were inadequate procedures in place to prevent wrong-way drivers from entering the freeway. The Arizona Attorney General's office will represent the state and would not comment on the case.
We should see sunny skies today in the valley, a high near 92 degrees. It's going to drop to 87 tomorrow, and then some clouds rolling in on Friday. The high expected to be 75 degrees, and we've got a 30% chance for some rain.
KJZZ is supported by the Nina Mason Pulliam Charitable Trust, working with Altered Tales to reduce euthanasia by providing spay and neuter surgeries for valley dogs and cats. Pricing information, alteredtales.org.
It's partly sunny in Phoenix right now and 82 degrees at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, we'll look at the possibility of Arizona voters approving legalization of marijuana. We'll find out why some state prosecutors have come out so strongly against it. Also, another supermarket chain is landing in the valley later this month, ready to compete with other big and small names, and Whole Foods is looking to appeal to millennials. What kind of impact could we see? I'll talk to former supermarket executive Joe Dobrow. And SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, has a new interim director. We'll introduce you to Sarah Cochran. We start today's program with the political system in Arizona, which has tried to address a lot of challenges in recent years, including getting more people to vote, limiting state lawmakers' terms, and creating a more level financial playing field for candidates. Those have brought mixed results, to understate things a bit. Now there are those who are looking into whether some of the state's elected positions should be appointed instead. In a Sunday editorial, the Arizona Republic advocated the notion of appointing members of the Corporation Commission. And last year on this program, education advisor Matt Ladner suggested superintendent of public instruction could be on that list as well.
I actually am starting to come to the view that it would be a good idea for the state of Arizona at some point to make that an appointed position. We need to have that whoever the next governor is, say elected in 2018 or whenever it's going to be, ought to have, no matter who it is, Democrat or Republican, they ought to have a free hand for setting a coherent set of policies to try to improve the public education system of the state of Arizona, in my opinion.
And that was Matt Ladner last year on Here and Now. Now I'm joined by Robert Ledger, opinions editor for the Arizona Republic, and Barrett Marson of Marson Media. Robert, how are you?
Doing well.
And Barrett, thanks for being here.
Good morning. How are you today, Robert?
I'm doing well, guys. I'm at a disadvantage because you're a lot funnier than I am. So.
He's usually funnier off air, though. That's sometimes the problem. Robert, what are some of the reasons the Corporation Commission was emphasized in your Sunday editorial?
Well, mostly because of just some of the developments here lately. I mean, for the longest time, the Corporation Commission has been pretty much an obscure agency. Most folks don't even really know it exists until a particular rate is up. But it's becoming more and more embroiled in politics, starting with the net metering thing, in which, frankly, the solar company fired the first salvo. APS returned fire in spades, and appears not to have looked back. It's becoming a more and more politically charged agency that should be focused more on technical questions way above my head.
Okay. And Barrett, before we move on to other ones, what do you think about CorpCom?
The Corporation Commission is both, a fourth branch of government here in Arizona and also definitely one of the least understood branches of government. But I disagree in that, the Corporation Commission does have a very important part in Arizona. You know, it sets the rates, essentially, for water, electricity, for many of us. And I think we need to hold those people who do that accountable. And obviously the way you do that is through the ballot box.
Yeah, and I think if they were being held accountable through the ballot box, one of those five would have asked APS to reveal how much they spent on political activity in the last election. None of them have. They've gotten the message. That's why we need to remove it from politics.
Well, and obviously, I'm not even sure, and I don't think anyone really knows whether APS spent a dime how much. It doesn't have to, just the way it did not have to disclose if it did anything. But the idea that APS bought anything, I think, is false. Obviously, there was a lot of dark money that came in, and people thought it was APS, and they ran a lot of ads. But in the end, it was a Republican year. You had two Republicans running against a couple of Democrats, and they performed just as well as any other Republicans in statewide elected office.
Oh, yeah, but I'm not just looking at the results of the election. I'm looking at the message that was sent. I mean, if there was any doubt about whether APS had spent the money, I think APS would have come forward and said, hey, we didn't do it. It was somebody else. And even if it was somebody else, they sure are enjoying everyone believing that they're the ones who sent the message. To me, more revealing than who won the election, and they're both good gentlemen, I'm sure they're going to do a fine job, more revealing was the fact that after net metering, you had one commissioner require APS to reveal how much they had spent on politicking. After this election, none did. There was a strong message sent.
Robert, one of the points you made, which I find interesting, I think it also falls into this category of some people who are calling for maybe the superintendent of public instruction to be appointed, is many people have such a passionate opposition to Diane Douglas, what she stands for, what they think she stands for. And you mentioned the Corporation Commission getting so much attention, whereas in the past it hadn't gotten so much. Moving forward, I wonder what you think about the idea of a governor having more of a defined cabinet. Are we looking for, when people vote for a governor, they sort of know what his or her agenda is on a whole variety of issues, including education, et cetera?
You know, the clip that you played from Matt Ladner, I think, made some good points. Our editorial this morning noted that right now, trying to determine who the education leader for Arizona is, it's not at all clear. I think you can make a good argument for the governor appointing the education, the superintendent. I think you can probably make a pretty good argument for that person being elected as well. That's a good debate to have. But yeah, maybe we do need to be moving more towards a defined sort of cabinet based on where the candidates stand on issues.
I think we can probably find common ground that the mine inspector is someone who definitely should be appointed and not elected. I don't know anyone who could name the mine inspector or who even knows if they voted for that person. But when you get to the superintendent of public instruction, there was a pretty clear election this past November, two very different kinds of candidates. There was significant money that backed the Democrat in this, and he also had significant bipartisan support, yet Diane Douglas still won. I think that was a message from the voters. And I really do believe that that is, you know, one of those positions. The superintendent of public instruction is one of those positions that should be elected. You know, Robert, you and I may also agree, maybe treasurer. You know, that is a office that is really run on autopilot. And I'm not 100% sure that that should be an elected. But superintendent of public instruction gets into a lot of media issues, for instance, down in Tucson for the ethnic studies program. And I think that's a person who also should be held to account for their decisions.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I come down on whether the superintendent should be elected or not. I think you can make good arguments both directions there. But I do think we probably need to, in the course of that conversation, figure out who is the education leader for Arizona. Is it the governor? Is it the superintendent? It can't be both.
I think the way the law is right now, the superintendent and the Board of Education, which obviously the governor has a lot of input on, that's where the leaders are. They just happen to be having a difference right now on some employees.
A little bit of a fork in the road on this one, guys. When Janet Napolitano left to join the Obama administration, there was concern that, of course, Jan Brewer's agenda was almost completely opposite from what Janet Napolitano's was. That, of course, brings in the argument again of lieutenant governor being kind of a running mate. But should voters have expectations that they voted for one person and this other person comes in and changes the agenda? Or there's part of me that sort of wants to ask a non-politically correct, non-good government question, which is that do more people need to vote? And if they don't vote, then basically we are left with the 20-30% to whatever who do vote.
You know, what I think portends is that, you know, the media should pay more attention to the Secretary of State race. I think there was a lot of criticism about some of the issues that were being discussed in the Secretary of State race, guns and gay marriage and things like that. But quite frankly, Arizona has a abundant history of having secretaries of state ascend to the ninth floor. So I think it is appropriate when we have that election to talk to candidates for Secretary of State about much more than just elections and paper pushing.
Robert, thoughts on that?
I think that did come up in our conversations with Mr. Goddard and Ms. Reagan whenever we were interviewing them. Their preparation for that eventuality. I don't think it's the most important thing that you should look at in electing a Secretary of State, but it should be a consideration, sure.
Guys, final minute or so, 30-second answer, sort of looking for, if in fact there is any momentum for this kind of thing that builds up, how difficult a transition, how difficult a change could this be? Are we looking at having voters change the Constitution? Are we looking for the legislature to act?
It would require a constitutional change to do anything with either the Corporation Commission or the superintendent or even the mine inspector. Those are all constitutional offices. I think the odds are against it happening, no matter how much sense it might make, just because inertia is such a powerful force.
But, you know, not only that, you have a public out there that is leery of even creating the lieutenant governor position. That has gone down several times at the ballot box, and the idea continues to percolate at the legislature. But getting past that hurdle of finding the citizenry to vote for that, to approve those kinds of changes, is difficult because, again, you know, they, I think, want to vote for a Corporation Commission, even if they don't know exactly what it does.
Barrett Morrison of Morrison Media, Robert Ledger, opinions editor for the Arizona Republic, at least coming to an agreement on whether the mine inspector should be appointed. Gentlemen, thanks for the time today.
Thank you for asking.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In the midst of her time as Arizona's governor, while she was the toast of the town in conservative circles across the country, Jan Brewer had a book published, Scorpions for Breakfast. Now Senate President Andy Biggs has jumped in, self-publishing The Con of the Con-Con. With me for a few minutes to talk about that catchy title and what the book is about is Ben Giles of the Arizona Capital Times. Ben, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is The Con-Con, and why did Andy Biggs spend 155 pages on it?
Well, the CONCON is Biggs's nickname for the Constitutional Convention, which is now better known as an Article 5 Convention, a collection of states calling for a convention where they could amend the U.S. Constitution by vote. And the idea behind this is frustration with Congress and a thought that an amendment such as requiring Congress to pass a balanced federal budget or an amendment to implement term limits for congressmen, these sort of things could help solve some of the ills that plague Congress and that a lot of conservative folks in Arizona, too, are upset about.
And Ben, you just used two more cons. You got Congress and conservative in there. So there are a lot of con-cons that Andy Biggs could have used. Is this, not to be totally sarcastic, but is this part of why he wanted a short legislative session to work on the book?
No, I think it looks like the book must have been worked on before that. It came out in April, so I guess just about the same time the session ended. But I think this is something he must have been working on for quite some time, and it's certainly something he's been outspoken about in the past. There's been a couple of legislative efforts the last few years to pass resolutions calling for an Article 5 convention, and Andy Biggs has the power as Senate president to basically sit on bills now and not let them go through the process in the Senate, and that's exactly what he did, in fact, just this session with one bill.
And Biggs was even criticized by Sarah Palin, who said he used Harry Reid-like tactics. What about that?
Yeah, last year, the same thing. Biggs was holding a bill, a resolution to call for the convention, and it's something that has a lot of conservatives fired up, and former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin even took to Facebook to claim that it was a Harry Reid-like tactic to not let the bill come to a vote on the Senate floor. And she urged people to call, write. There were folks with signs picketing outside the Senate calling for Andy Biggs to let this bill go. But he has remained a staunch opponent to it, and I think that's backed up even more so now by the fact that he took all this time to write a book explaining why he thinks it's such a bad idea.
Ben, how is Andy Biggs viewed by colleagues now? If you give us sort of a broad base of that, because during the Medicaid expansion battle, Biggs was basically rolled by a number of his fellow Republicans, and yet he was really considered to be in control of this latest legislative session.
He is very much in control, and you have to remember that there were only a handful of Republicans who were a part of that vote for Medicaid expansion, five or six, depending on which vote you were looking at that year, 2013. But now the makeup of the Senate has changed. There are fewer of the moderate Republicans who voted for Medicaid expansion in the chamber, and he has a pretty good vice grip on what's happening in the Senate at this time.
Ben Giles of the Arizona Capital Times. You can follow him on Twitter at Ben_Giles. Ben, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about the legalization of marijuana, the pros and cons of that in Arizona. And later this hour, we'll introduce you to the new director of SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting all night long music of the 1980s, featuring favorites from Elton John, Lionel Richie, Cyndi Lauper, and more, May 16th and 17th. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
And good morning. This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Join us today at 1 for BBC News Hour. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, fair skies and 57 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 65 in Prescott, sunny and 78 in Tucson. It's 80 degrees in Casa Grande, partly sunny skies and 83 degrees right now in Yuma. Well, KJZZ reporters are also public radio listeners. For the next few weeks, a KJZZ staff member will pick their favorite morning edition story and share it with you. You can see what others are listening to by visiting KJZZ.org and clicking on I Like This Story, or visit our Facebook page. Right now, we have partly sunny skies in Phoenix, and it's 82 degrees at 11:23.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Disagreements over the potency of marijuana and whether it's a so-called gateway drug to stronger substances are continuing in political and social circles. And in a couple of minutes, we'll feature a couple of guests who will talk about whether recreational use should be approved in Arizona. Before we get to that, I'm joined by Leslie Engelking, president of FOCUS, the Foundation of Cannabis Unified Standards. She'll be presenting next Monday at the Mesa, rather next Sunday at the Mesa Arts Center as part of the Science of Cannabis Summit. Leslie, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's make sure I have that date right. It's May 17th. It's Sunday, right?
It is Sunday,
okay,
yes.
Okay, terrific. What is FOCUS and why did you start it?
FOCUS is the first company and the only company, actually, to create accredited standards for quality and safety for the cannabis industry. So each state creates their own regulations, but there is not a lot included in those regulations that monitor the actual product as far as how it's produced, what's used as far as pesticides, and how it's handled, how it's packaged. Those sort of things have been left out. Each state has produced their own regulations kind of based on the state before them. And since there's no real guidelines, they're all just sort of guessing and building off one another. So we created FOCUS in order to put some safety and quality standards in place for business owners to be able to use to have operating procedures and things like that, just like every other industry does.
That seems like it would be pretty important when we think about the quality of a substance that people want to use and whether there's consistency in terms of how it affects each person.
For sure. And also, I mean, especially because in most cases, this is being considered as medicine. So when you think about people using this in immune systems that are already compromised, it's really important that they're not putting, you know, pesticides and different things in their bodies that are going to hurt them. And even when they're, you know, the process with a lot of extraction, they're using different oils and methods to extract the product and put it into an oil form. We need to look at what the long-term effects of that and the chemicals that are used in that is on not only just the people that are using the product, but on the employees and the workers and being around that type of environment. So
on Sunday, you'll be comparing the use of marijuana to narcotics in your presentation. Can you give us kind of a Cliff's Notes version of what you'll be talking about?
Yeah, generally, I come from a background in pharmaceuticals, so it's something that I've spoken about before, just looking at the differences in how narcotics are used to treat pain versus cannabis and cannabinoids, and a little bit of history on what pain is. It's an interesting paradigm because there's a lot of negativity in the public, in the media, in even from regulatory on the use of how much use there is in cannabis for chronic pain. But when you look at how cannabis affects the body and the endocannabinoid system within the body, and the fact that the cannabis plant is made up of cannabinoids, it really makes a lot of sense. And so my talk is just going to focus on that and explain why cannabis works so well to treat pain and how the similarities between opioids and narcotics and cannabis and cannabinoids, and just talk a little bit about the statistics about pain and explain what pain is and that sort of thing. Just a general overview kind of for the public. I mean, the important thing about this conference is it's really just geared about bringing, you know, personal experiences and feedback that are from people that are really passionately involved in the cannabis industry, that there's so much science that's really out there and it's being explored privately, but, you know, in states here and across the world, but that isn't really necessarily communicated to the public unless you're really involved with this industry. Now, a lot of people don't get that information. And so the public knowledge is, the level of knowledge is generally the same as it was, you know, years and years ago.
But Leslie, let me jump in, though, just because there is such disagreement about the science of cannabis and whether it actually does help with certain things. If you find the science so convincing, why are there still such disagreements about it, do you think?
Because of the fact that it's still federally illegal.
Okay.
It is illegal to do research because of the federally illegal status of it. So there can't be a lot done in our country, but internationally, there's a ton of research being done, and more and more as the states are legalizing it, there will be state studies done. So we're getting there. But really, overall, there is a ton of good research out there if you really look for it. And I think this conference is nice because it brings people who understand that, who have looked into that, together, and it puts them in front of the public instead of just in front of other people in the industry talking about it and sharing their knowledge with one another. It really gives the public a chance to hear different perspectives from people who have been around that.
Leslie, one final thing. If more research is done, are there certain other illnesses or things related to pain that perhaps cannabis might in fact help that we haven't talked about in the past? Because there's the list, of course, that in our case, the Arizona Department of Health Services has. You can use medical marijuana for certain things. Are there other things that are not being talked about that could be if the research were made more public?
I mean, I'm not a physician, and I don't, you know, but the possibilities are endless. I mean, humans have an endocannabinoid system throughout our entire body. Every cell in our body has receptors for cannabinoids. So it's an amazing thing, and then cannabis consists of cannabinoids, so they work to build back our cells in our body and regeneration and help with our immune system. There's so much potential out there. So the day that research is unlocked here will be incredible.
Leslie Engelking is president of Focus, the Foundation of Cannabis Unified Standards. She'll be presenting on Sunday at the Mesa Arts Center. It's part of the Science of Cannabis Summit. Leslie, thanks for filling us in.
Thank you for your time.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Voters in Colorado and Washington were the first two states in the U.S. to approve the legal use of recreational marijuana. But the idea has gained some momentum in a lot of other states. And in Arizona, a ballot measure has been introduced to allow residents who are at least 21 years old to possess and even grow limited amounts of marijuana. Later this hour, we'll hear from an opponent of legalization. Right now, I'm joined by Carlos Alfaro, who is Arizona political director for the Marijuana Policy Project. Carlos, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
So 150,000 signatures are needed to get this on the ballot. You need those by mid-July. Why do you think there's momentum for getting all those signatures?
Well, I think it's part of a movement that's happening across the country, and it's really interesting to see how the opposition is diminishing in numbers, resources, even support. So this ballot initiative represents a strong majority of Arizonans that know that a marijuana prohibition has been an utter failure, and we have public support on our side, and we're excited to get that in the ballot for next year.
If this goes forward, who could use marijuana and how much could they use?
Well, it's adults over 21, and that's one of the reasons that this is such a much more preferable system than we have today. Instead of having it in the underground markets with the criminal levels, we are going to push that out like they've done in Colorado and Washington and in other states, push out the criminal underground market with a legitimate licensed businesses, ask for an ID, and eliminate that segment.
There are some who have been concerned about the way things have worked in Colorado and Washington, that there are pitfalls. Of course, when you're kind of the pioneer, there are going to be problems with that. Are there things you've seen there that you think are very positive, but also lessons that you could have learned from those other states and what they went through?
Well, actually, Colorado and in other states, I think it's almost half of the country now has some sort of industry for marijuana, and it's up legalized and in the, in the light. Traffic fatalities have been down, even in the states that have legalized it. There's a much better system of identification. So I think we have seen the successes and the benefits that we can gain as Arizonans from this. Millions of dollars towards public education and public health. So it's gone very well, and it's just one of the dominoes in the rest of the country.
People involved in campaigns never like to hear this question, but why is now the right time? And if it's not the right time, and it doesn't go well, you get on the ballot, but it doesn't emerge victorious, is this a continuing fight, or you have to sort of go back and say, maybe Arizona is not the right state for this?
I think this is really just a matter of time, not just for the country, but also for Arizona. We see high support for millennials. I think almost 70% of all millennials support some sort of regulated system for marijuana. And then the people that aren't millennials, the older generations that have seen marijuana prohibition fail, not working getting it off the streets, not working getting it out of the schools, they see a benefit in changing our view on marijuana policy and having a regulated tax system that provides benefits for all of us.
Carlos, there are still some, though, who, because marijuana is illegal, they see it in a very different way than they might see alcohol. They may see people who use marijuana as, oh, those are sort of those people I don't really want to associate with. Is that not the perception anymore? Or if that is among some, how do you change that?
Actually, I think over half of all Americans have used marijuana, and a vast majority of them are productive, hardworking citizens that after work choose to have a little bit of marijuana rather than a beer or a cocktail with friends. This shouldn't be a crime. Responsible marijuana use should not be a crime. It should be legal. And, of course, the benefits from regulating it just give it that cherry on top. And that's why I think we're seeing also the big support.
Just because there is general public support, and of course, if this is on the ballot, public support means everything.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, is there that feeling that just because the public wants it, that makes it good?
Definitely. With everything comes consequences. But I think that the personal liberty message, the getting government out of our personal choices really resonates with our state and with kind of our culture down here in the Southwest. So it is a lot when you're asking for ballot initiative to get that support. And I think we have the culture and the momentum to really have it go through this time around.
There have been arguments over the years about the so-called drug war as to whether it's been completely ineffective, somewhat effective, whatnot. Are we in a situation now, though, where a lot of people who would like to use marijuana are able to get it, that there is less of a crackdown on that? I guess I'm sort of wondering how much of an impact you think legalizing it would there actually be that many more people who'd want to use it?
Yeah, and that's I don't think so. There is nobody that's being stopped from obtaining marijuana at the moment. In fact, if you go step on a college campus, even high schools, which is a little sad, you will see that it's almost easier to get marijuana than alcohol. And the reason is because there's no system there. There's no structure. There's no oversight. And by doing this, we're removing that underground market and putting it up to the light and being able to see it. So the impacts could actually be really good. Monitoring who sells, who buys it, and of course the benefits.
Are there any concerns that in legalizing marijuana, whether or not it's a gateway drug, some argue it is, some argue it isn't. If it isn't, and let's say we get the cartels out of the business of marijuana, is it possible it's even more dangerous as they move to harder drugs? Could that, in fact, be a problem? Not that everyone's going to start using harder drugs, but those who do, there could be additional problems.
Well, of course not. I think that the basis for this campaign is that marijuana is objectively less harmful than alcohol. This is the money is going, part of it to public health. This is definitely a way to better do our marijuana policy. I don't think that there's ties of gateway drugs or anything like that. This is not a campaign to, talk about other drugs or anything like that, because marijuana is specific to being less harmful. Obviously, heroin and all those, harder drugs are not in the same category, and therefore it does not help our cause.
You've mentioned money and that perhaps going to education and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little more idea? If in fact this were to pass, who would decide, is this going to be done by the State Department of Health Service? Who would decide the regulation of it? Who would decide where the money goes?
Sure. The money is actually going straight to the schools, so there's not going to be any political battle on how it's going to be allocated or anything like that. 40% of it is going to go towards public education, which includes new facilities and compensation for K-12 teachers, which is a big, a big point of our campaign. Also, all-day kindergarten, which is very important, especially for parents that are trying to, get ahead and are caught up with their kids and work. And then also for public health, the remaining 20% will go there. So it's going straight to the schools.
My final question, and I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I'm still wondering sort of why this is the right time. I mean, I get that there's momentum for it, but when you think about why, is this the idea that 2016 is a presidential election year, a lot more people will vote, so rather than having it an off year, I guess I'm wondering why now as opposed to 2 years ago, 2 years from
sure.
now?
Sure. I think that the mountain of evidence is just really pushing our opposition to just cling on to fear, fear of change, because now we see that with millennials and with people that have gone through marijuana prohibition, they know that there's a better way. There's more evidence towards marijuana being even beneficial for some medical conditions, and definitely evidence to show that it's definitely less harmful than alcohol. So people, not only is it the right time in public opinion, but the amount of evidence that's out there. Anybody can do a Google search and see how marijuana really does affect the body and how it is in a completely different league than alcohol. It would be ridiculous for us to say, let's punish somebody for having a few beers after work or out with friends. It's equally as irrational to say that somebody should get punished for using something that is less harmful than alcohol.
Carlos Alfaro is Arizona Political Director for the Marijuana Policy Project. Carlos, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. And now joining me for a few minutes in opposition to the legalization of marijuana is Sheila Polk, Yavapai County Attorney. Sheila, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
So what are your biggest concerns before we get into some specifics?
My concern is with a drug that is harmful, that is addictive, that is mind-altering, and is particularly harmful to the developing adolescent brain, which develops until about the age of 25. You know, it always puzzles me that people who are in favor of legalizing marijuana never stop to ask the question, how is it that the drug makes me feel so good? Because the answer is that marijuana is causing profound changes to the brain, both in terms of its function and its structure, in ways that are harmful, negative, and can have lifelong negative effects. So my focus is on our kids and our kids' future, and what kind of environment do we as responsible adults create for our kids. We know for a fact kids who use marijuana are much less likely to succeed in school. There are long-term consequences in terms of IQ for folks who start young and who use long-term. In fact, show an IQ loss of 7 to 8 points. And so my focus is on keeping a substance illegal that we know is harmful and that we know is a significant obstacle to our kids and their successful future.
Sheila, I want to ask you about the perception of things as well, because certainly there are people who don't want to see underage and kids using marijuana, but there are many underage people who use alcohol, and that can be a real problem. You know, we've heard about binge drinking. We've heard about you know, poor kids over-drinking and ending up in horrible accidents. I guess I'm wondering, where is the line between alcohol and marijuana, in your opinion?
Well, it's illegal for kids to use alcohol, but you raise a good point, which is alcohol is a product that is legal for adults. And in fact, the result is that twice as many of our kids are using alcohol as use marijuana, a substance that is legal.
Sheila, would legalization of marijuana increase difficulties for law enforcement? It may seem sort of contradictory, but could it potentially lead to more problems with cartels? I asked Carlos the question about this idea of more hard drugs being used. Maybe not an increase in who's using it, but the fact maybe cartels would say, well, marijuana is no longer something we can make money off of, so we'll have to try these other things.
Well, that certainly is the experience that we see come to Colorado already. They legalized marijuana for retail purposes in 2012. About 40% of marijuana that is coming out of Colorado is illegal, and in fact is being illegally trafficked to, the last time I saw the figure, was 40 of the 50 states. So legalizing marijuana in Colorado has not put a damper on illegal trafficking activity at all. In fact, it seems to have increased it.
Do you think national polls that indicate support for legalization show that marketing campaigns are working, or does that show that people have determined for themselves that it makes sense?
I think it shows the effect of marketing and the effect of propaganda on what people think. What's interesting, though, is if you sit down with a group of people and you talk to them about what this drug actually does, how it harms the brain, and how it's particularly harmful to kids and their learning environment, most people will quickly change their mind. And so polls that are out there are pretty basic. The most recent poll for Arizona shows that the majority of Arizonans do not support legalization at this point.
Sheila, I'm wondering, when it comes to, again, we talked about alcohol and use for adults, what if this potential ballot initiative were written in such a way that said people 25 and older could legally use it, based on what you said about the developing brain, would that change your opinion at all?
Well, not at all. The problem is the single most effective way to keep our kids from using marijuana is to keep it illegal. If you legalize it, even though it's legal only for adults, we know for a fact that far more kids use. That's certainly the experience out of Colorado, where their kids ages 12 to 17 are now using marijuana at a rate 38% higher than the national average. And a study that was done for Arizona determined that if marijuana is legal, 32,000 of our high school students who have never tried marijuana indicate that they would be more likely to try it. The fact is that when something is legal, it is more acceptable. And the public thinks, well, if it's legal, it's safe. And if something is legal, it is more accessible. So you have that acceptance plus accessibility means far more kids using than if it is illegal. And I'll repeat it again. Mm. The single most effective strategy to keep our kids from using marijuana to keep it illegal.
Final thoughts. Where do you stand on medical marijuana? And do you think those who pushed for that were using it as a stepping stone for legalization of recreational use? Or do you think they sincerely think medical marijuana is a good thing?
Well, Clee, the marijuana policy project, that is their strategy. It's not a secret. It's they're Washington, D.C. They hire local directors in the states that they have targeted first for medical marijuana and then for retail or recreational marijuana. That's their strategy on their webpage. And the strategy they developed 20 years or more was that to go in, get the voters to accept medical marijuana, and then follow in a few years later with retail or recreational marijuana. That's what they did in 2010. They financed, along with some other backers, financed medical marijuana for us here. And now they're back 6 years later pushing retail marijuana.
But finally, what do you think personally of medical marijuana now that it's been approved and put into effect?
Clearly, the marijuana plant has therapeutic value. Everyone recognizes that. The issue is, how do you safely separate the chemicals or the products in the marijuana plant that has over 400 chemicals? How do you safely separate that, put it into medicine, and deliver it in clear dosages? That's kind of the definition in the United States for safe medicine, is medicine been tested and can be consistently delivered in dosages that are measurable. The problem with the idea of smoking your medicine is, of course, you can't control the quantity, you can't control the quality. But clearly, the marijuana plant has medicinal value. The challenge is, how do you extract it and deliver it in a safe way to consumers? I know that there's lots of research done out there, that products are being developed, and I believe that there is a product shortly to be issued in the United States specifically to address epileptic seizures, but will be delivered in a manner that is consistent with how we do medicine in this country, which is medicine that is safe, medicine that is measurable, and that is consistent.
Sheila Polk is Yavapai County Attorney. Sheila, thank you for your time.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
And still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk about yet another supermarket coming to the Valley, and we'll meet the new director of SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Mountain States Employers Council, educating and supporting HR professionals and business owners at its 6th annual conference on June 3rd at the Scottsdale Resort and Spa. More information at msec.org.
Good morning, it's KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Taking a look at Valley traffic right now on I-10 eastbound, watch out for a crash in the median, that's at 67th Avenue. A sunny and breezy day today in the Valley, we should see high near 92 degrees. It's going to drop to 87 tomorrow and down to 75 on Friday when we've got a 30% chance for some rain. We've got NPR's Here and Now coming up at 12 o'clock. A ceasefire appears to be holding in Yemen so far. Yoki Driessen of Foreign Policy magazine will give us an update on the conflict. And a new study on premature babies is giving pro-life advocates fresh support on Capitol Hill. Here Now from Boston starts at noon. Partly sunny skies, and it's 82 degrees in Phoenix at 11:46.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Later this month, there'll be another entity trying to get the money you spend on produce and ice cream and dog food. The Valley supermarket scene has been called one of the most competitive in the nation, so Hagen has decided to jump in by purchasing a couple of Albertson stores being closed because of a merger with Safeway. With me to talk about that and other supermarket stuff is Joe Dobrow, former executive for Sprouts and Whole Foods. He's also author of the book Natural Profits, which covers the natural food and grocery revolution. Joe, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. So what do we know about Hagen's? Is Hagen's in the natural food realm at all?
No, I think they're mostly a conventional grocer. So they're based up in Bellingham, Washington, and they're really a small player. I mean, they only had, I think 15 or 16 stores up there before this whole Federal Trade Commission forced divestiture started. So they are jumping into the big time overnight.
Wow.
They're acquiring 150-plus stores on top of the base of 15 or 16 stores that they already had. So I think it remains to be seen what they actually are going to look like.
I read a quote from Hagen's CEO that it aims to be a combination of Safeway, Albertsons, Trader Joe's, and Whole Foods. Is that possible, or is that like saying he wants every single person to think that he or she could shop there?
Well, again, I haven't been in Hagen, so I have to reserve judgment about how far they have to move to get to that point. But I certainly have been in Albertsons, and look, I think the reality is if you have a Chevy Nova or a 1984 Chrysler K car or something like that, it really doesn't matter how much you pay Maaco to paint it. Underneath, it's still a Chevy Nova. And I'm impressed with what I've read that has said they're transforming these stores in 40 hours. But the reality is you can't change the culture in 40 hours, and you can't change people's minds in 40 hours. So underneath, it's still Albertsons, and Albertsons is a very middle-of-the-road kind of a supermarket that appeals to people who think that supermarket shopping is a chore or an errand, not a joy and a pleasure. And there's certainly a place for that, but I think Hagen is going to have to really move the needle a lot if they're going to change that perception.
Another big announcement that came out last week, Joe, is that Whole Foods is going to try to appeal to millennials by making shopping more affordable. There's that phrase some people call Whole Foods whole paycheck, because for some people it costs so much. What do you think about that, trying to appeal to millennials? Can that be done effectively?
Yeah, really, really interesting announcement. So if you take a look at the millennials, on the one hand, I think there's sort of this tendency among those of us in marketing to kind of look at it as the demographic flavor of the day. You know, there was a time when we were all excited and nervous about the advent of Gen X, and, now Gen X shops at Albertsons. But the millennials really are a different group. First off, they're massive. I think I read that they now comprise 25% of the U.S. population, and they've got spending power of over $1 trillion. But the important thing about them is their values are very different. You know, they have grown up in the era of the recession. They don't want to be marketed to. They reject big business, big systems, big government, but not in the way that people did in the 60s by revolting against it. They just sort of take this logical rejection, this laissez-faire attitude that says these things are irrelevant to my daily life. So you juxtapose that against Whole Foods, which has built a massive and hugely successful business that's based in large part on status and, higher quality foods, and this whole effort to try to get people to live higher than they actually do. So will that work? It really depends on what they're going to come out with in this new format.
Yeah. Joe, I need to jump in, but thank you so much. Joe Dobrow, former executive for Sprouts and Whole Foods. Also, pick up his book, Natural Profits, which covers the natural food and grocery revolution. Thanks as always. Have a good day.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. The Valley has seen significant leadership changes in the arts community. The Phoenix Art Museum and Musical Instrument Museum have brought in new directors, and the Heard Museum is searching for its next leader as well. Earlier this week, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, or SMOCA, named a new interim director, Sarah Cochran, who had been associate director. She'd previously been curator of modern and contemporary art at the Phoenix Art Museum. I met her at SMOCA's offices and asked whether there are greater challenges in reaching her goals for contemporary art in the Valley.
Oh, I think contemporary art is hard in every community. There is no doubt that this is a more conservative socially community than many others. But I like to say this is the most compelling environment I've ever worked in. Every issue that contemporary art has ever given lip service to is going on. And so that means that what we do here is matters. I would also say the community is not as jaded as perhaps in other communities. And God bless them, they turn out.
What do they like to turn out for that you've seen so far?
So I've been in the Valley now for 6 years. I think that everybody in their right mind would show up for Maya Lin or for other major artists. But the community constantly surprises me. I mean, I've shown films where perhaps I thought I wouldn't have such a big audience. 100 people came and saw Hunger by Steve McQueen, the film about the IRA hunger striker Bobby Sands, and God bless them, they stayed. Almost 200 people came to see the three-hour version of Andy Warhol's Chelsea Girls on two 60mm projectors. So I think they are interested and curious.
When we think about contemporary art or any sort of art, whether it's the more traditional or not,
What is ultimately the goal as far as an audience is concerned? Because there are some who say, there are some people who just aren't going to be attracted to that sort of thing. Is that okay, or is your goal to get as many people as possible?
When I teach, I like to say you do not need to like all of contemporary art. Nobody does. If you meet the artist halfway, if you understand what the artist is doing and you do not like it, that is okay. That is called taste. There are some contemporary artists I do not like. However, if you don't meet the artist halfway, if you don't understand what the artist is doing, I sometimes wonder why people get so worked up about it. If they have no skin in the game, why would they care?
Do you think this is a community that is ready, the broader arts community, that is ready to take off in some way? And I mean, there've been a lot of changes over the past couple of decades, and people liked them to some extent because it showed that this was a really growing city, growing community. As we have more people involved, there's been a little bit more frustration with the direction things have gone. Do you think it is time to have more sort of new faces, new voices? Do you think this area is ready for that?
Yes, we always need new voices, and we need to get our voices out. And so I would say that, you know, as much as possible, traveling exhibitions, bringing people in, there's many, many different things we could do. Yes, the community has some extraordinary artists working here. It's about how we project ourselves out to the larger national and international audience is what is going to matter.
Should Smoka have a particular stamp? Should Arizona museums, Valley museums, have a particular sort of mark that they make?
I think that every community has its flavor. And, you know, we've seen some rather remarkable types of expression be produced here. I mean, I'm thinking of Matt Moore. What other community could have produced Matt Moore? But I would equally say the kind of artistic expressions that happened sort of post SB 1070, again, that was very much of our time, our place. That was our flavor. So yes, God, nobody wants a flat world. Hopefully not even the Luddites want it. That's got to be very unfashionable, hopefully.
You are well thought of. Not long ago, I had some editors from the Phoenix New Times with me to talk about some of the things that the Valley needs to do to improve the art scene. And your name was mentioned several times. I presume that's flattering, but also, how do you feel about that? How do you feel about being seen as this sort of shining light?
I think that people are incredibly kind. I do something that I adore within a community for whom I have enormous respect and friendship, and I love what I do. I am merely trying to do my job. I am happy when people recognize that perhaps I do some things well, but I'm Scottish. We have had any idea of... we have a different sense of ego, shall I say.
Is there a feeling, though, when one has, again, is well-regarded in that sense, that your impact can perhaps be greater because people will sort of be inclined to follow you because they trust you?
Again, I'd probably just not put it in those terms. I'm not trying to be evasive. I just do my job, and that's my focus. Yes, so there.
Sarah, when you're a curator, when you're interim director, as you're going to be, what's an aha moment for you in terms of an exhibit, in terms of an artist?
You know, some of the greatest moments of my life have been in contemporary artist studios where they surprise you. There was a point in my life where I had to make a decision about studying more historical art or contemporary art. And the thing about contemporary art is that it's alive and it's about us. So my last aha moment was talking to Kay Twist of Post Commodity, and he started to outline on a napkin at AZ88 his ideas for Post Commodity's piece Pollination, which is a peep show that reveals a garden. And given the water politics of the Southwest, we may be slightly better off here in Arizona, but the specter of what's happening with the creeping brown lawns in California, that was just a remarkably brilliant piece, and it was great fun to be able to bring that to community.
What sort of impact can contemporary art have? What is that impact like? What should it feel like?
I think that the impact on individuals is different. Personally, I pay a great deal of attention when I see a work of art or a body of work by an artist that annoys me. When I first saw Jeff Koons's work, I was so angry, and I couldn't quite understand why I was so angry, and it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about paying attention. I think art takes time, but it's worth the time. To be part of a conversation of the intellectual edge of our time is essential, and artists often reflect much larger historical changes in a very articulate but also perhaps on a very emotional level. That is a hugely exciting area to work in and to work with the artists.
Some have been concerned about sort of Marshall Way, which sort of traditionally in Old Town Scottsdale was a place, galleries and whatnot. And they're slowing down quite a bit, I think, would be the universal feeling about that. Does that indicate anything to you? Is that a sign that things are just more modern, or is there something to worry about there?
I think if you think about Soho in New York in the 1980s and, you know, what a vibrant part that was, and then, you know, the galleries moved around New York and variously ended up in Chelsea. The energy moves. Last year I went to a conference in Detroit, and one of the things that a local arts activist said to me was that the energy in Detroit is stable, but how that energy manifests itself is transitory. And so I think that we have to think about that also. As long as there is a space for artists, you know, artists are the avant-garde. They're the ones who are going to show you where the new interesting parts of the city are. And so they will move on. They are driven by economic necessity to find and create new and interesting places. There are our leaders. That's what's exciting about it.
Finally, do you and other leaders of the arts community here need to collaborate, need to cooperate? Should there be almost to sort of compare it to the movie that's number one in the country the last several weeks, should there be like a superheroes of arts community where they're really sort of working toward one goal, even if they bicker amongst each other?
I'd have to go to the gym a lot more before I get into a Lycra suit. There are others who are in much better shape than I am. Yes, of course we have to collaborate. We are an ecosystem, and all parts of the ecosystem have to be strong and healthy. The artists have to be strong and healthy.